Can an Italian-made Jeep make it in America? The North American International Auto Show, did Ford dominate for the second year running? And what's the matter with Volkswagen?
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Henkel, excellence is our passion.
This is Autoline After Hours with Gary Vasilash, episode 272 for January 30th, 2015. Jeeps, GTs, and Volkswagens.
Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Now, you may have noticed that we haven't been on for the last 2 weeks, and that is basically because we had the North American International Auto Show, and then last week, John and the crew were at the Auto Dealers Association out in San Francisco. And as you'll also notice, John isn't here again tonight. So, first of all, let me say we will be on next week, and you're going to want to watch next week because we're going to have the ATS-V in the studio with the chief engineer, Tony Roma. And I want you to keep watching tonight because we have a really great show. Now, John is driving BMWs down in Austin, Texas at the Circuit of the Americas, the Formula One track, which is really a wonderful racetrack. I've had the opportunity to drive there with the SRT Grand Cherokee, and it's a lot of good fun. So we've got two guys with us here tonight, Jeff Sabatini from Car and Driver. Jeff, what's the favorite track you've ever driven on?
My favorite track?
Your favorite track.
I don't really have one.
All right, so which track did you enjoy driving on?
Laguna Seca.
Yeah?
And no, I'm not going to say Mazda Raceway at Laguna Seca because I think that's ridiculous. Laguna Seca.
Yeah, and you stayed on the course. You didn't?
Oh, I cut right through the corkscrew because
yeah.
The quickest path between two points is a straight line.
Mm-hmm. And we have Dave Sullivan from Auto Pacific. Dave, have you a favorite racetrack?
Not a favorite, but let's stay local. I like Gingerman.
Yeah?
Yeah. I spent a lot of time out there in college. So.
As did Jeff. So anyway, so it's all good fun. And, you know, and it's sort of a point that, you know, this is one of the things that we get to do that regular folks don't get to do quite so often. And it's sort of like an inside baseball thing that we have. And
drive on racetracks?
Yeah. If you're not a race driver. Now,
right.
Presumably, if you were having your Sunday track day of some sort.
Well, I think there's a sizable portion of automotive enthusiasts who do track day type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
ECA is huge. BMW CCA is huge. SCCA is huge. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and are those tracks, but I mean, like, you know, Solo 2 racing or that kind of thing, too.
So. Mm-hmm. Or Woodward or Telegraph or...
Yeah.
Places like that.
Or M14.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, sort of the point is that, you know, we get to know people over time. And so a lot of PR people that we have to deal with on a regular basis. And so the last week, the guy named Tom Kowalewski died. And Tom has quite a career in public relations. He spent time with Renault. He spent time with Chrysler. He became the corporate communications vice president at General Motors. Then he went over to BMW, and then he ostensibly retired from BMW, and then he was with Lincoln. And so he's 63 years old and died suddenly. And so John was interested in you know making sure that we gave a tribute to this guy and you know said something about him. You certainly knew him over the years, Jeff.
And, not really well.
But who he was.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, he had the unfortunate task of doing corporate communications for GM during the Zarella years, which was when I met him.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, it's unfortunate anytime someone dies but especially when it's kind of a sudden thing. Young guy, he was just at the auto show, so it's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. Did you know him, Dave?
Yeah, he. You know that somebody had to be pretty special if they bring him in to try and liven up what's going on at Lincoln. So, yeah, he was, you know, I mean, take it for what it is. I mean, what's going on at Lincoln? But at least he.
So did it work out for Lincoln? Do you think did it work out for Lincoln?
I mean, he was kind of a more behind the scenes kind of guy, playing, you know, a little bit of Geppetto. But I think he was, you know, they're trying. They're trying to do the right thing. You know, trying to do something different. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's not like when he was working at BMW, but I think they, you know, it was a good effort. At least Ford recognized somebody that had some talent and experience, and they brought them in to try and turn things around.
Mm-hmm. So another PR guy, and he'd worked with Kowalski at I believe when they were at Chrysler, Jason Vines, who's been on this show many times, and so this is another sort of an inside baseball but big controversy that Car and Driver ran a interview with Jason Vines, in which Jason called the former Detroit bureau chief of the New York Times a prick and a piece of shit for his reporting during the Firestone period of time. So again, John thought that this was going too far, and it was unacceptable, really, to attack someone personally. You got any sense of that?
I mean, isn't that Jason kind of his style? So, I mean, you never know what's going to come out of that guy's mouth. But I don't really know either of them, so I don't think it's really fair for me to talk about that. Mm-hmm. But I don't really think that's needs to rehash something that happened 12 or 13 years ago about somebody. So I think it's kind of uncalled for.
So quite possibly just Jason trying to shill his book.
Sell a few more copies, you know, double sales to 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with John. And I'm not going to say anything more about it since it appeared in our magazine.
it sort of seemed to me to be an odd thing that would be in Car and Driver magazine, though.
The feature that it was in is every month we do what I'd do differently, you know, and we do an interview with somebody.
Right.
So we have a long-standing, you know, history of interviewing people in the business and asking them, you know, to expound on things.
Right.
So.
But again, whether the people who are going to track day who are reading your magazine care about Jason Vines calling Bob Nardelli a clown,
we are eager to cut through a lot of the sort of corporate double talk, and I think the fact that Vines was one of the few PR guys who didn't engage in a lot of that and who, you know, spoke freely and openly about things made him kind of larger than the inside baseball character. Mm-hmm. You know, people knew who he was outside of the industry, at least in the enthusiast community, because of the fact that he was a personality like sure. Lutz or, you know, he became larger than his job.
He was his own brand in a lot of ways too.
Right. So when you become larger than your own job as a cog in the corporate machinery, and he was.
Okay. So last topic about the media. Okay. And I thought this was interesting. And I was surprised to see that the New York Times has canned their automotive coverage.
Well, that happened before the Detroit Auto Show.
Right. It's been for some weeks, and I happened to see Lawrence Ulrich, who had been their chief auto critic, and I said, you know, what happened? And he said, well, when you're cutting like 120 people from the newsroom, they have to make a decision of, you know, they're going to cut Milan Fashion Week or they're going to cut automotive coverage. And it just struck me as sending some sort of a message about how the auto industry is being perceived in the arguably the newspaper of record in the United States.
As a former New York Times reviewer and also former Wall Street Journal auto critic, you know, the problem is the people in New York don't get the auto industry. I mean, and to a large measure, people outside of the Midwest don't get the auto industry. You know, look what happened with the whole bankruptcy thing and all the whole, you know, Republican witch hunt against Detroit. You know, I mean, it's people in New York tend to think that cars are all yellow unless they're the black ones that take them to and from the airport.
Mm-hmm. So it's a really good idea to move your brand to New York.
You know, if you're in Detroit and Cadillac, you want to move them to New York, that sounds like a great idea, Jeff, right?
Well, I'm sure they can get a really good deal on the space that Mercedes is vacating by moving to Atlanta, of all godforsaken places.
I think it was kind of sad, you know, in a lot of ways, but not surprising either.
You weren't surprised?
No.
I think the thing with the Times, though, to go even worse inside baseball from the auto industry to the newspaper industry, but, you know, they package the auto section with all the classified ads there's no classifieds. It's all Craigslist. You know, there's no classified ads anymore. And, you know, we don't see it in the Midwestern edition as much, but in the, you know, New York edition, you know, that the auto section was the cover of that formerly thick tome of dealer advertising, and that's just not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, that's too bad because they did some brilliant work.
Well, it's too bad because Jim Cobb is one of the best automotive minds and great editor and a great guy, and Norman Mayerson, who was also, you know, I worked with at the Times when I was there. I mean, those two guys did such a great job with that coverage, and I go down the whole list of all the people. They actually had a wake for the section. I could talk about that for a while, but I'm not going to.
So
but they were all good people, and it was quality stuff. And now
that's my point. I mean, it was good coverage, and it was being done by people who really understood the auto industry and understood cars. And I think much of what we're seeing now is being done by people who don't have that depth of knowledge.
And I liked reading it because it was nice to get somebody that's not in a Detroit mindset, you know, what are they thinking? You know, how do they perceive this vehicle in a different market or a different mindset than what we're used to seeing here in Michigan? So I enjoyed reading it, especially Mr. Cobb's stuff.
Yeah, Cobb's a great writer and a great editor.
So, okay, no more media talk, no more PR people talk. We'll move on from that. So last week I was in Hollister, California, and had the opportunity to drive the new Jeep Renegade, which we'll talk about here in a minute. But before we do that, I talked to Mark Allen, who is the head of Jeep Design, and Mark does a walk around and talks about the features that they brought to that vehicle. So with that, Ben, let's run Mark Allen.
Okay. What we got here is the 2015 Jeep Renegade, brand new vehicle for us, and it goes into the growing B-segment SUV market. It's Jeep's entry, first time we've done something like this. Real unique project for us. All the design and engineering was done up front in our shop in Auburn Hills, Michigan, and then the project was transferred to our partners at Fiat over in Turin, Italy. The vehicle's made actually in Italy and then brought back here. Some of the design features of it, what makes a Jeep, again, big, large, round headlights, braced by the 7-slot grille, which we've had since day one, really, of Jeep. Real aggressive approach angle. This happens to be a Trailhawk model, so it includes these forged steel tow hooks. They're rated at 2.5 times the GVW of the vehicle. Moving down the side, some of the design features of it, all the line work on it is very vertical. It's sort of a cube with flat roof, very vertical windshield. The front end's very vertical. And the tumble home or the side glass raid on it is actually unwound, very vertical, and we drop the belt line. So it's got a lot of glass on the sides. The vehicle's got great visibility. Some of the details on it, the trapezoidal wheel arch is part of this big flared fender. A lot of the details are a bit exaggerated on it, the lights, the mirrors, the fender flares, all to impart a real fun character to the vehicle. Moving to the back of the vehicle, the theme continues. The aerodynamic spoiler, which is, we called it sort of a baseball hat on backwards, shoots off the back of the vehicle. the shape of the backlight is more of the trapezoid shapes we see on the side of the vehicle. And the taillight's a great story. It's sort of disintegrated from the body, not unlike a Wrangler. There's a detail in here, the X, which we got from the military fuel can from World War II. And you'll see this X appear on the roof, in the headlight, taillight, and a lot of the interior pieces as well. The roof features what we call a MySky system, and it's two opaque plastic panels. The front either works electrically like a standard sunroof, it rolls back, or alternatively, both panels can be lifted off the vehicle and stored in the back. They're very light. And they fit neatly in the back under the cargo floor. So that's it. 2015 Jeep Renegade goes on sale next month.
Okay, and then you have it, the Jeep Renegade. Now, you know, it's interesting they took us to Hollister to drive that because that's where they had the drive program for the Jeep Grand Cherokee. And it was an off-road course, and they wanted to show that this small, cute-looking vehicle could actually deal with off-road situations. And you've had the opportunity to drive this car, Jeff?
Yeah, we've had both of the versions, the one with the small turbo four-cylinder and then the larger 2.4-liter four-cylinder in our office, and I've driven both of them, both manual and automatic transmission.
You driven a Trailhawk then as well, or?
I don't believe that either of them that we had were the Trailhawk version. I think, I like the, if you can keep the cost down, I like it more.
Mm-hmm.
It seems rather aggressively priced. I mean, it's...
To the low side.
No.
You think it starts at like 18.
Yeah, but, and that's what I'm saying, is if you can keep the price closer to 18, it's a lot better. It gets really expensive, but that's kind of the problem with a lot of Jeep models, is that, you know, they are fairly Spartan. I mean, I think even the base model doesn't even have air conditioning, does it? I think that's part of a package.
Maybe, but I know the Dart, you can't get air conditioning, can't get air conditioning on, but...
You can't get air conditioning on the Dart?
Yeah, it's an option on base one.
So you can get air conditioning.
But I mean, I know that's a Chrysler kind of thing to do, Fiat thing to do, so...
The larger four-cylinder, I think, it offers no extra performance in the real world for the price. I mean, it's... I like the manual... The cheaper manual four-cylinder version was definitely more to my liking than the more loaded-up one. I mean, it's got that 2.4-liter nine-speed combination that's from the Cherokee, and I don't find that to be a great powertrain combination in any vehicle.
But the Renegade is, I think, 700 pounds less than the Cherokee, so its performance of that engine is better than... it is in the heavier vehicle.
And the 1.4-liter turbo is...
I think it's 1.8.
Isn't it 1.4?
No, it's 1.4.
Yeah,
it's the same one as the 500 Abarth.
Yep. Same multi-air.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not... Neither engine is great, but save your money. I mean, what do you need to go super fast in this little compact four-wheel drive vehicle for anyway?
I'd take that over a Soul. I mean, you can get a Soul up to... $27,000 now.
Yeah.
So
I think
that over Soul.
I feel exactly the same about the Soul. Is, you know, the lower you can keep the price on these things, they offer so much more value at the lower price points. Although the Soul has so much more standard equipment than this, but this has all wheel drive. So
how do you guys think it's going to do in the market? Do you think? I mean, I wonder whether there won't be some cannibalization from Cherokee sales.
I don't think so.
I don't think so. It's totally different price class.
That's why I think there might be some cannibalization.
You could say that right now, because you look at the price point for Patriot and Compass. One of them, I don't remember which one. One of them is like $15,000 to
Compass. Isn't Compass cheaper?
It might be Compass. I can't remember since they repositioned them, since they were right on top of each other.
Right.
But you know, one of them's dirt cheap. Mm-hmm. So I don't, you know, you could say that right now. And both of those are still selling really well.
Mm-hmm.
Cherokee is really selling really well. So.
Yeah, Cherokee is just completely on fire.
Well, I think this is going to appeal to people who would not normally walk into a Jeep store.
Why?
Because of its looks. No, but it doesn't look like a Jeep. It looks like a cartoon Jeep.
Yeah.
You know, it looks like the Jeep that you buy for your toddler to drive around. And that's cool.
Are you saying
that's
it looks
cool.
like Power Wheels?
Yeah, pretty much. No, it's and I.
So is that a good
I like
thing or a bad
it. Yeah,
thing?
No, I think it's great. I mean, it doesn't have that super macho look that I think the other.
Okay, well, if you look like a Buick Encore, I think the proportions make it look a little awkward.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't look awkward to me.
No,
I actually find it to be more attractive than the Cherokee. So,
because it looks more like a Jeep.
Yeah, it looks more trucky, boxy looking. It doesn't look like a.
Well, I mean, because, you know, Mark Allen, which he didn't say in that interview, was basically saying that they had to look at it. You know, when he looks at designing a Jeep, he has the Grand Cherokee on one end, and then he has the Wrangler on the other end. And so when they did the Renegade, they decided to, you know, go more in the Wrangler direction than in the Grand Cherokee direction. And so then you could argue that Cherokee is, you know, a variant of Grand Cherokee in terms of its lines, and this one with, you know, more upright, the slotted grille, very obvious, which, you know, you don't have in the Cherokee, is why it looks the way it looks.
I think it looks like the Wrangler's little sister.
So, you know, one of the things, do you guys think that the fact that this is coming out of a plant in Melfi, Italy, will take away any Jeepness from it?
No.
Nobody cares.
I don't think anybody cares.
You know, the consumers these days are so detached from any of that kind of stuff.
If you're concerned about it, you're going to go get a Wrangler. It comes out of Toledo. You know, I don't think people are really going to care.
Mm-hmm.
I think it will probably piss off the Wrangler buyers, though.
Yeah.
You know, because the Wrangler people will not like it, but they're not going to buy one anyway.
They were already
so why
off.
Are the Wrangler people not going to like it?
Because it's that whole patriotic American, you know, lunatic fringe.
But they already had CVTs and, you know, when Daimler put, you know, CVTs in the Compass and Patriot, they already pissed off all those people. So
right. They got to have something to be pissed off about.
Why do they need something to be pissed off about?
Well, because that's patriotism. isn't the number one, you know, unifying force in nationalism is hating somebody else and having a common enemy?
And this has what to do with cars?
Probably nothing.
probably nothing. No, I mean, I just found it very interesting that, you know, they're looking at this as being, you know, a vehicle that is really going to propel them in markets that they need to get giant sales numbers. And so, you know, great sales in Europe, great sales in China. And
I think it'll do well. If they can sell 30,000 a year, they'll be pretty happy.
You think 30,000 a year? And
in the U.S.
What do you think? Any?
I will defer to his expertise on that.
Yeah. 30,000, that'll be the number?
Yeah.
And if they get that number, then things will be fine. Okay. So we're going to take a quick break here. Okay, we're back, and we want to thank Bridgestone for that sponsorship for us. A couple weeks ago, North American International Auto Show. What did you see that you really liked a lot?
If I had to pick one thing, Avenir. I think they did a really good job.
Okay, so this is a Buick car.
The Buick concept, which they did an excellent job of keeping a secret, which most things are not a secret anymore. You know, leaking everything on the internet and teasing and whatnot. This was, I knew when I walked in there for that reveal that there was something going on. I mean, there was senators there, congresspeople, there were tons of Chinese people. I mean, there was something going on, and I was...
Free food?
Yeah, there's a little of that. But, you know, it was just good to see that, you know, people can, you know, a company this big can keep a secret from everyone like that these days, and I think
and so there it is on the screen. This is the Avenir that he's talking about, talking around.
It's original. It doesn't look like a knockoff of something else. It's
so this thing. This is an enormous car. I mean, when I saw this car, it's like, oh my god, you know, what is?
But they had to do it before because the Cadillac CT6 is coming out in New York, so they had to get this out before before that came out. So you know, I mean, that, yes, it's primarily designed for the Chinese market, but you know, it's a really good looking car. I mean, when was the last time you were like, hey man, that's a really good original-looking Buick. Nobody's really ever said that.
So that car was designed in the Australian studio. I thought that was interesting. And then you're mentioning the China market. I mean, for a while there, what was the Buick that they made a big deal out of the interior being designed by a woman from China? Remember that?
There have been a number of Buick concepts that have not...
No, this is a production car. Was it maybe the...
I don't know.
Le Sabre, maybe? But anyway, but I thought it was interesting. So, but the interior was done in Detroit for that car.
It's a really slick piece of engineering to come out of GM. But I really like that they kind of did this before the Cadillac model came out, so it doesn't look like an afterthought to what Cadillac had. And you know, given that all the sales success they've had in China, this is what they've been waiting for there. I mean, this is so important to that market where, you know, you have a driver. They've been waiting for something like this there for a long time.
So even though this was a concept, you think this will be a production car?
Yes.
I thought GM said it wasn't going to be a production car, though.
Yeah, well.
So they're just lying?
Underneath that thing was a real car.
Well, I was impressed with it as well. It looks like this could be Buick's Audi S7. You know, it's got that teardrop rear that looks kind of like the Boattail Riviera from the early 70s, which I liked a lot. It's a great-looking concept car, although, you know, GM's track record with great-looking Buick concept cars has not been good over the years. I think maybe they managed to keep it a secret because it's a Buick.
So there was another Buick, the Cascadia, the convertible.
Did I say it correctly? Cascada.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So
another warm.
You won't be the last one to say that.
Another warmed over Opel product.
Buick's an interesting brand because if you look at it, I mean, like Encore is a Korean car. Regal comes from is an Opel. The Verano is, you know, an Excel from China. I mean, it's a really strange brand of.
It's basically Saturn 10 years ago. The dumping grounds for stuff from other markets with Buick badges, right?
Yeah, now we get the Polish-made Cascada.
So, is there a market for convertibles? Or did the Sebring say that was
I mean, the 200 was pretty much the only competition this thing really had. Even the Eos is gone now. So it owns the market, so you should see plenty of these in Florida around Disney World.
Yep. To rent one from Enterprise.
Yeah, this will be a...
So it'll be a fleet vehicle?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Jeff, what was your favorite at the Detroit?
The Ford GT, unquestionable. I mean, it was... Couldn't stop walking by there and looking at it. It was appealing immediately and throughout the rest of the show. I don't think anything even came close to it. It was very interesting, too, because of its positioning right outside of the Ford stand was Acura, where the NSX, which we've been waiting for it seems like, you know.
Seems like 5 or 6 years, but it's, well, we have been, but
it's been 10 years.
Yeah.
It's been 10 years since the old NSX.
Teasing us with concepts for.
And they couldn't have been more different. Everybody looked at the production NSX and kind of went, oh, that's nice. And the GT was just holy, you know, expletive. I mean, people were tripping over themselves to get close to it. So
another one, we had heard they were working on a supercar before the auto show, but I don't think that was really on anybody's radar what that really was going to come out to look like.
Well, see, we knew they were going to have a new Ford GT, but,
yeah.
You know, that doesn't mean anything. I mean, the second Ford GT was just a sort of clone of the first Ford GT.
Updated it was styling of the original.
It was a retro kind of car. And so you're going to do a new one. What can you do? And, wow.
They broke the mold on that one.
Yeah, so everybody knew it was coming, but nobody knew what it looked like. And
they kept that a really good secret. I hear that they had it buried in some secret basement.
It was like in the basement of the product development center, like way far away with janitor supplies or something on the door. I thought it was interesting. Before they announced it, I was talking to David Woodhouse, who's the Lincoln Global Design Director, and I said to him, I said, so, you know, how do you like it? He goes, I don't know, I haven't seen it. So, I mean, if you've got that guy who hasn't seen it, and then... So you guys were talking about the previous GT, which was done by Camillo Pardo, mm-hmm. who we had on the show here, I guess it was in December. And I happened to see Camillo looking at that car, and I was with Craig Metros, who is heads up Ford Exterior Design for North America now, and he'd worked on the GT. And so we decided we'd ask Camillo what he thought about this car. And... He was saying something along the lines of, well, you know, it's interesting, but, you know, wait until they come out with a production version of that car. And Craig Metros looks at him and says, but Camillo, that is the production version of the car.
Right.
And Camillo goes, holy shit. I mean, he was just blown away that this was the real car.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd call it production. I mean, it's going to be extremely limited, built in, you know, I don't even know where they're going to make it yet, but... not going to be like rolling down the assembly line at 60 jobs an hour or anything. I mean, mm-hmm. it's going to be all hand built,
right?
You know, kind of a low volume.
So this leads to a question. You know, and you're saying that, you know, you look at the NSX and say, well, you know, compare it to this car, and you know, there's big differences, even though that there are some, you know, design characteristics that you see are very similar to it, but. Is it that maybe that the NSX is a production car that is, you know, it's not going to be rolling down, you know, the line in Marysville and you know, outnumbering Accords, but, I mean, they're still planning on, you know, building a factory to build this vehicle, and that maybe it's having to accommodate manufacturing?
Yes and no. I mean, look, they're both going to be six-figure supercars, right? They're both going to appeal to a wide enthusiast demographic, but are going to be purchased by a tiny number of people. So if Acura chooses to build a lot more NSXs than Ford's going to build GTs, so they make another handful of people happy, I put them in the same category. I mean, even if the GT, mm-hmm. the GT will probably wind up costing twice what the NSX will, but... Mm-hmm. They're still halo cars.
But don't you think that the NSX is more attainable by more people, and so you're looking at it from the point of view of, okay, if we have to make X plus something versus we just need to make X. Because what we want to do is go to Le Mans next year and win, which I'm guessing is the reason why the GT
exists.
You could
say about a GTR. I mean, it's $100,000. You know, what you blows things away that cost $1 million. So you could say the same thing. It's not exactly setting the world on fire with sales. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think you're kind of getting at the business case behind the two cars.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
there's no business case.
I don't. Yeah. It's
like, for either of them?
No. No, they're. It's all about.
Well, come on, the
all about image. It's all
come
about.
Come on, the GT has the EcoBoost, and Ford is making a big deal out about that. So.
Yeah, some.
But it happens to be a 600 horsepower EcoBoost.
I was listening to these on Industry Day after the media days at the auto show. I was listening to these two guys saying, "Yeah, well, what if that GT had a V8?" and one guy says, the other guy says to him, "Yeah. Just think of what it could be doing if it had a V8 in it." And I'm like, you know, they're going to appeal. These cars, I mean, they're going to appeal to different people, but we're talking about like 1% or, you know, they're going to appeal.
But aren't these the automotive enthusiasts who these cars appeal to?
Absolutely.
So
yeah, but we like them.
Right.
Like,
so I'm saying so that 1% is basically, you know, it's a larger number than it would be were people all excited about I don't know, the Renegade.
But I think we live in a society where I don't think people really get excited about the Renegade anymore. People don't get excited about cars anymore. I mean, outside of enthusiast circles, and it's unfortunate. But we've reached this era in which, you know, the appliance, the Camry, you know, that's it. That's how these that's the business case. You really want to talk about business case? It's, you know, building a more efficient appliance.
It's very difficult, I think, to get, you know, some limited vehicles like the 300 when it came out. You know, people got excited about it. I remember, you know, that was a big deal. But it's very rare for a mainstream car to be.
What's the hottest segment in the market right now? Small crossovers. They all look the same. They all have middling performance. None of them handle. They're not about driving. They're about infotainment systems, phone connectivity, and fuel economy.
Sort of cool seating, or.
And being able to fill up the back with mulch.
I think that whole connectivity, infotainment, et cetera, thing is not driven by the market. I think that the market basically is very happy with their iPhone or their Samsung Galaxy phone, and they've got all they need there. I think that most people are buying these things because they want to sit up higher than other people, and that's basically what it all comes down to, and that this other thing is just basically the auto companies trying to make themselves seem cool and relevant by offering this stuff because it's working out for the guys in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, and most of the people working in marketing at the car makers are just terrible at their jobs. I mean, they've got the most sophisticated, expensive, amazing consumer product that's ever been devised, and they're marketing it like a $200 phone. Mm-hmm. It blows my mind, and we talk about this pretty much every day at Car and Driver, is how the car companies have just given up on trying to get people excited about cars, to educate people about cars, to make cars as awesome as we think they are, and they've just given up. They're content to just tick boxes and market this stuff in the same old silly ways, and then go after the tech angle, which, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's.
But everything has that now.
Okay, but do you guys at Auto Pacific, I mean, have you done any surveys that indicate that people are clamoring for 4G LTE in their car, or they want to have a
nothing like
you
that.
Know an 11-inch touchscreen rather than a 7.5-inch touchscreen?
No, you see more people wanting. They basically want their phone. They don't want to pay for a phone, and they don't and some sort of expensive infotainment system in the car. They just would rather buy one.
Right.
And if you think about, like, the average age of a car these days is almost about 12 years old.
Right.
You would like to have that to be upgradable at some point.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to have, you know, if you're going to go buy. I was talking to somebody, and they wanted to go buy a 2008 911. Certified pre-owned 911. And they're like, I can't find one without navigation. Why do you want one without Navi? Because I want to keep this car, drive it for a long time, and I don't want it to look really old in 5 years.
Right.
Because, for obvious reasons. So there's definitely people that just would rather buy something one time, like a phone, and have it, be easily upgradable. So, I mean,
well, they buy a phone, and then two or three years later, they buy a different phone. But then they have
to see a lot more phone mirroring software come out in the next year. There's a whole, like, GM's got a whole new infotainment system coming that's going to be, it's just phone mirroring.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see that coming out later this year. So, but that's what people want. The dumb radio is coming a lot faster than you think. But that's what people are looking for.
So what's a dumb radio?
Probably the best example today, the closest thing to what I would consider to be a dumb radio would be like in the Sonic and Spark. There's no CD player. It's basically a phone mirroring type of system that, you could have the navigation on your phone. Of course, you have to buy their app, and then it would mirror from onto their...
But you get a tuner? I mean, do you have an AM, FM
no,
tuner?
No, you still have that. Okay. But what basically the processing power is your phone,
right,
not in the head unit. Mm-hmm. So it keeps the cost
so down. Much better than Cadillac Q.
Yes.
It's so much better.
But, yeah, but the point is that they're trying to position like, oh, we got cool stuff, and that's the kids are going to want to buy that.
But it's not cool stuff is the problem. I mean, that's like the biggest problem is it's not cool stuff. It doesn't work.
Yeah, they spend a lot of money developing all the software.
It's buggy.
And it doesn't work. It's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, something like the CarPlay system that Apple is rolling out. I mean, that if that can work as well as imagined, that's the killer app.
Did you have a chance to play with the Ford one at the auto show?
I haven't seen it, and I've only read what it's how it's supposed to work.
The Ford one, what?
They have a mirroring software that will be.
But it's not CarPlay.
Trying to do their own. No, they're trying to do their own. CarPlay and Android Auto are basically two that wouldn't matter if you got in a Hyundai or a Volvo. They'll look exactly the same. But automakers feel like they'll lose their DNA if they give up. You know, that space, that real estate.
But isn't, I mean, it goes back to Jeff's point of you know, isn't the auto company's job to make cars that people want to buy? I mean, cars, not to build, you know, electronic systems that they're not very good at building anyway?
You'd wish.
I mean, so it just puzzles me why they spend so much time, energy, effort, and money on creating systems when, you know, there are a whole bunch of people who already know how to do that.
Yeah, they're valuing that, you know, that's they think that they're experts at that, and they don't want to give up that real estate to somebody else because now, you know, like as I said, I mean, you could have, you know, a Kia Rio, and it's going to have the same thing as an S-Class in it. You know, they want to have that distinction between brands, and they feel like that they're you're watering that down by offering the same experience in each car.
Well, and part of this is that right now there's a certain amount of smoke and mirrors that the auto industry is deploying to separate mainstream brands from luxury brands, and the amount of extra profit they make from selling the same car as a, you know, a Volkswagen Golf and an Audi A3, you know, the, you know, Lincoln MKZ and the Ford Fusion. You know, I mean, you've got all these sorts of platform sharing deals with all these extra profits for the premium brand. You know, this is one of the key areas where they're already hurting from having all these features having crept down even into subcompacts, because it gives people little reason outside of the brand mystique to buy into the luxury brands.
See, but it almost strikes me that if you're somebody who is very happy with the performance of your cell phone, and then you are forced to spend, you know, a whole bunch of extra money to get something that doesn't work as well as your cell phone, how are you going to feel about that vehicle manufacturer?
Isn't brand loyalty right now at an all-time low?
Pretty much.
So.
And do you think that this contributes to it?
Could. Bad experience.
Sure.
I mean, if you had a really buggy My Ford Touch experience, would you want to go get another one?
You don't want to touch another one?
Yeah.
Ooh, awful. Okay, so we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
A little chemistry goes a long way, especially when it comes to vehicle development. From enabling the use of alternate materials to withstanding extreme vehicle environments, Henkel's adhesive, sealants, and surface technologies provide solutions for every vehicle segment. Come see for yourself. Our Detroit area headquarters offers 12 research and development and testing laboratories with the ability to do full-range testing and validation on actual vehicle parts. Sign up to tour our labs at henkelna.com/tour.
Okay, so our thanks to Henkel. So we have a couple of questions, a couple of phone calls have come in, so we'll take those, even though I thought I said we weren't going to have questions, but questions are good. So, Ben, bring us a phone call.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. With Cadillac moving to New York City and Mercedes moving their headquarters from North Jersey to Atlanta, do you think Caddy can pick up any talent unwilling to move to Atlanta, or will they just squander the opportunity? Thanks.
There's actually not going to be that many people. From what I understand, it's only going to be about 50 people at this office in New York for Cadillac. Mercedes-Benz has well over 1,000 people, so I think it's going to be a pretty limited opportunity. I'm sure they'll be able to pick a couple people, but I think the idea in that Johan has said he doesn't want any petrol heads, and he doesn't need any more, so I don't think they'll be looking at Mercedes-Benz.
So would Mercedes people be petrol heads?
I mean, yeah, essentially, if you're already coming from one brand, I mean, he's going to look outside, you know, in other industries to, you know, whether it's some sort of hotel industry or something where, you know,
so all about that'll be good for making these desirable cars that people want, right? Going to the hotel industry?
Whatever it may be. Well, what I'm getting at is that he's trying to think outside the box to look for people that can bring in other ideas because he feels that that's...
I mean, I'm sure you have some other idea on that.
Cadillac already builds great products. I think General Motors engineering has never been the problem. You know, I mean, certainly GM has had plenty of issues over the past years, but really what Cadillac is fighting about is a brand perception issue, and I don't know how they ever recover from that. Honestly, how do you ever truly bury the Cadillac Cimarron and all the mistakes that were made? You know, the only thing that they really can do is just wait it out until everybody that remembers all the terrible cars from the 70s and 80s are out of the mix. And I think that's Cadillac's problem, and I don't think New York is going to solve that.
I don't think it'll solve it either. And I think they're building some. I mean,
it'll mean Dinesian doesn't have to live in Detroit, though. So that will.
His wife's from here, so.
But I mean, to the point of the question, doesn't it seem that Mercedes, which is doing considerably better in this market than Cadillac is? I mean, Cadillac has been doing abysmally in this market. That there've got to be some people there in sales and marketing that completely understand how to appeal to the luxury car buyer in the United States. Therefore, if you want to get that, you bring them into your company because they don't want to move to Atlanta.
I think there'll be a few.
Right.
But I think there's going to be more opportunity here in Detroit.
For people who work for Cadillac?
No, if Mercedes-Benz people want to stay in the auto industry, there'll be probably more opportunity here. What's left in, there's BMW, Volvo in New Jersey. I mean, they're...
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not moving, then that's what's left. So,
right.
Just the office is going to be so small in New York.
Mm-hmm. But it'll be cool.
I'm sure it'll be très chic.
There you go. Okay, so we have another phone call. Ben, please bring it in.
Hey, guys. Great show. Wondering Jeep Renegade versus Buick Encore. Which is better? Which do you prefer? I think the Encore starts around 25 grand. With that 1.4-liter turbo and a 6-speed automatic, that thing can't get out of its own way. So how does that compare to the Jeep? And do you recommend the 2.4-liter engine with more torque? Obviously, most people aren't doing manual transmissions, so let's just compare automatics. Let us know. Thank you again. Have a good day.
Have not driven the 1.4-liter turbo in the Renegade with an automatic transmission. So being someone who tends to not like to comment on things that I don't know about, unless...
That's fresh.
No, I don't know. I haven't driven it. I mean, if it's... I don't know. I don't particularly think the 2.4-liter is a good value. So that's my concern. The Encore, I just... really can't get over its styling, and
I don't think you're saying that in a good way, that you're just so taken with the styling that you just can't get over, huh?
No,
fabulous it is.
I I literally cannot get over it. I cannot get over the styling to get in the car because it's so awful looking.
The only one I've driven was front wheel drive. I mean, you can easily chirp the tires in it, which I think for that buyer, it does what the buyer is going to want it to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not buying that thing to take it to the drag strip on Friday night. So, I mean, it was fine. My mother would be plenty happy driving that.
Yeah, I mean, it almost seems to me that although the Renegade is small and the Encore is small, that there's very little crossover in terms of how they look or what they're supposed to accomplish, what they're supposed to do. I mean, you know, the Buick being, okay, we're going to be more of a luxury car, and so if you don't have a whole lot of money, you want to go in the luxury area, get this. And then contrary-wise, you've got the Renegade, which is basically saying, you know, if you don't have a whole lot of money and you want to get something that is, you know, truly Jeep-capable and truly a Jeep, and it looks like a Jeep and it acts like a Jeep, here it is. It's
I just
Jeep.
Think the soul. I think the soul is a much more where the Renegade is competing. It's kind of like it's the all-wheel drive soul that Kia hasn't been willing to make. Mm-hmm. I think
until Chicago, we'll see an all-wheel drive concept.
So you think is this inside stuff we have here? Were you breaking news?
No, that was out today.
That they're going to have
teaser. Yeah. But I think Jeff's right. I mean, there's no, it's a person that's really concerned about, you know, image, and I mean, you don't go by a soul because, you know, Camry was too exciting for you. You're going out to buy a soul because you like the way it looks, fits your image, and there's a lot of value in that car. I think that you can get a lot of equipment for really not a whole lot of money, which is kind of a rare thing these days. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty space efficient too because it is a box. Mm-hmm. So. But, you know, you look at, like, a Juke, where it's just like, it's another B-segment crossover, and it's like, no room in the back seat, the trunk is pretty much useless, so.
Okay. All right, so we have another phone call, and then when we go from that phone call, then we're going to go to another space-efficient car. So, Ben, bring in the phone call.
Hi, this is Ryan from Wolverine Park, Kansas. I'd like to know your guys' thoughts on Kansas City Power and Lights, our local utility here. Their announcement recently that they're going to put 1,000 charging stations for electric cars in and around the Kansas City metropolitan area. This will include quite a large number of fast charging stations, but not complete 1,000 there. I'd like to know your thoughts and what you think that the implications are of utilities becoming a competition of sorts for gas stations and such. Give me your thoughts. I appreciate it. Love the show. Thanks. Bye.
I'll let Jeff go first.
Well, I think it's great. I think we need more charging stations in the United States. I think that at least where I live in Ann Arbor, a few years ago, every time I had an electric car on test, it was like, awesome, I can just go park downtown and there's plenty of places to plug in. And, you know, it was great on a weekend because you didn't have to look for parking. Now there's never any room at the EV chargers. They're all full of Chevy
volts.
All full of volts.
Yeah.
And, you know, people that park downtown have had to, you know, like wait outside the charging station and find the other people and make friends with them to work a platoon system and that. So, I think that plug-in vehicles they're here. They're not going to go away and disappear. And more charging stations opens up a wider market for them, and I think they're good technology.
Dave?
You look at like the overall business of a electric company, we're becoming, you know, more efficient. We're moving to fluorescents and LEDs. We're doing things that require less energy. I mean, these guys they're in business. They are looking for new revenue sources. So anything to use more energy, I think, is part of their business plan. And, make it easier. Mm-hmm. Make it easier to buy electricity from me. And that sounds like
I don't understand why these petroleum companies aren't jumping on all the alternatives that they can and say, okay, we might lose some new electricity. Let's start putting charging stations in our, you know, BP stations.
Because they're not making the electricity. So.
And or even hydrogen and things like that. I mean, it'd be a great opportunity for them that they may be missing the boat on. So Anyway, so I happened to be in California again. This time we were in Julian, California, where everybody goes to eat pie. But the reason they go up there to eat pie is because there's twisty roads, and guys like Jeff really like twisty roads a lot. And so I had the opportunity to...
I like pie, too.
And you like pie, too. The Volkswagen Golf R, the most powerful Golf we've had out there. And so I had the opportunity to talk to the program manager for all of Golf. So, Ben, let's run this tape, and then we'll talk about the Volkswagen. Hi, we're here in beautiful Julian, California, with Michael Klepetowski, who is in charge of the Golf family at Volkswagen of America. And the most important part is that we're here with the newest member of the family, the Golf R. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about this wonderful car that we just drove up here?
Sure. So this is the 2015 Golf R, which is the next car that we're introducing as part of the Golf family. So it's based on the Golf and the GTI that have been winning awards in the last year. But this is just kind of a amped-up Golf with all-wheel drive and almost 300 horsepower. It's one of the most powerful Golf we've brought to the U.S. on 0 to 60 under 5 seconds. So we're really excited about it.
So turbocharged four-cylinder engine?
Yes, turbocharged four-cylinder engine. It's based off the EA 888 in the GTI, and then with some additional bigger turbo and different cylinder head, things like that, which get it up to the 292.
So the horsepower difference between a GTI and the R?
It's about 80 horsepower, 70 with the performance package. All this extra performance, 292 horsepower, 280 foot-pounds of torque, but still 3 mpg improvement on a highway, so 30 mpg highway. So all that performance still with efficiency in mind and great performance.
And you do have some design cues, so someone who's opting for this car rather than the GTI will be able to have some points of
sure.
difference?
Yeah, I mean, there's the front and rear bumpers are unique, so we've got the unique bumper with the air inlets. The headlights are actually also unique to the Golf R, so both of these LED DRLs are illuminated, so somebody that knows the R really can tell far away, even in the daytime, that it's an R approaching. And some of these chrome elements here, silver elements that replace what on the GTI would be red. And then at the rear, also unique rear bumper. And for the first time now, we'll have quad exhaust on the rear. So Golf R always had a unique type of exhaust, center exhaust, dual exhaust. But for the first time now, we'll have the quad exhaust on Golf R. And then just little things like black mirror caps, the R badges on the fenders, and the unique wheel design, the 19-inch wheels.
So another thing that is interesting about this car is that you have a DCC system.
Yes.
That allows people to set the car up for the conditions that they want to drive it under.
Exactly. So it just really adds to the versatility of the Golf. You can set the car to a comfort mode or a race mode and go get groceries, go shopping, or take it to the track.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for your time, and very nice car you guys have here.
Thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I found really astonishing is I was looking at the Volkswagen sales numbers last year, as I am wont to do. And so even though the Golf is like the world's car, I mean, it sells everywhere and everybody buys them, that in the U.S. market last year, the Golf GTI outsold the normal Golf. Now, admittedly, the numbers weren't big because GTI sold 17,362. The regular Golf sold 15,941. Why does nobody buy Golfs in this country?
Because it's not a crossover. I'm not kidding. I mean, if you want to sell a hatchback, it has to be a crossover here. People just don't want to buy hatchbacks.
The better question is why Volkswagen hasn't lifted the Golf a couple inches and marketed it as a compact crossover, which they do sell a version of that in Europe.
It would sell great here if they did it.
Well, except it would still be too expensive.
Too expensive.
But the larger question is, how is it that what was the market up last year, 6%?
I mean,
sales?
Depends. It was up and up over the last year, yeah.
And were Volkswagen sales down 10% last year? I don't know if my numbers are correct.
Volkswagen.
Because I don't have a small computer in front of me.
But Golf was also...
Volkswagen sales were down 10% last year. Okay. So they were down 10% in a market that was up arguably 6%.
But Golf was also...
6%.
Everybody knew the new one was coming out, and
right.
So people were holding back.
But then again, the new one came out over 2 years ago in Europe, mm-hmm. and they waited before they brought it here. So, and the sorts of people who buy Golfs are largely actually... you know, my type of people, enthusiasts, and that's why they sell so many GTIs. The GTI is arguably one of the best values you can get in an inexpensive performance-type enthusiast car. For whatever reason, they can't seem to sell the standard version as well. Part of it is that poor powertrain, it was old, and everybody and their brother knew that the new one was coming because it's been on sale for over a year in, in Europe. But, you know, Volkswagen's products just are so not right for the U.S. market outside of Jetta and Passat. And they've had so much time to figure this out. And I don't know why they can't. They don't have any actual crossovers.
Okay, but
other than Tiguan.
Okay, but total Jetta sales were down 1.8.
That's not, but that's like a, it's a real SUV.
Yeah, it's got a real SUV price tag too.
Yeah, it's a brand
Cherokee kind of.
And I mean, it's a brand engineered Porsche Cayenne. Mm-hmm. So I mean, Volkswagen is just kind of a mess in the United States, and yet you know they got this plan to be the world's largest car maker.
Right, and that's what I don't understand. I mean, but you were saying Passat.
Nobody
understands. But I mean, their sales were down last year, both of those.
Well, because they're old. Because they introduced these products with a lot of fanfare, and then, mm-hmm. you know.
They get old, they get stale pretty quick. I mean, look at Passat, and it's now like the oldest sedan on the market.
Well, and that, you know, their sales in 2011 and 2012 were just gangbusters because they had new Passat and new Jetta. But then the problem is that they don't have the product refresh cycles. They don't have, and they also, you know, I don't think Volkswagen really had a consistent strategy in the United States. They kind of like try to do something and then they kind of lose interest. And this whole midsize crossover thing, I don't understand. It's been years now that they've been saying, "Oh, we're going to build it. We're going to build it. We're going to build it." And now it's still
they're
going to
build it.
Yeah.
Well, they got that big plant in Chattanooga. They got to do something with it.
Yeah, they're putting Passats on every rental car lot in the country. They got to be getting pretty bored down there because mm-hmm. the sales for Passat are so mm-hmm. so poor that I cannot be running full time down there.
Yeah. But that I'm sure you'll enjoy the opportunity to drive the R. I'm sure you'll get a
well,
lot
I'm
of
sure it'll,
a
I'm
lot
sure
of
it'll be good.
I'm
that.
Sure it'll be great. I'm sure but it'll be $40,000 or something.
And they'll sell 5,000 of them.
It's pretty much the number they're looking at.
And you know, just like the R32 and the last Golf R, and I mean, you could actually, as much as I hate to say it, you could make a good case for them not selling it here at all because it doesn't even matter to the mm-hmm. brand. It so has nothing to do with anything else they're doing in the United States.
Well, they're selling all those GTIs, and so you just upsell someone who's going to buy a GTI.
But see, that's the whole problem, is the people that are buying the GTIs don't have them. It's in a whole nother price category. GTI starts at 25, mm-hmm. you know, so.
Cloth seats. And
it's aspirational.
There's really nothing about Volkswagen that's aspirational, and that's kind of the problem.
Okay. All right. So with that I think we're going to...
I would totally agree with you.
Well, no, I mean...
Full agreement here.
That's what they've decided. I mean, Volkswagen used to be aspirational, but then they decided they didn't want to be aspirational. They didn't want to be a cheaper alternative to Mercedes and BMW. They decided they wanted to compete with Koreans.
You know, when the Jetta first... You know, when the Jetta came out, like 2002-ish... I mean, it was notorious quality problems coming out of Mexico, but every sorority girl wanted that car. And if you go to Germany, that's what old people drive. That's the Crown Vic or the Grand Marquis of Germany. But you know, that was what girls wanted to be seen in. It was like kind of a strange, you know, it was a good image car. It was that whole thing has kind of evaporated, and it just came and went. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you look at like. Tiguan, you're like, it's so expensive, it's so small, and it just, they could sell them if it was the right size and the right price, but it's more of like a Renegade size almost inside.
Yeah, for, it's not a
crazy price.
It's not a U.S. market product.
No, and that's part of the problem. I mean, you can't take a car and either decontent it to the point where nobody wants it, like they did with the Jetta. They, you know, selling one without a radio in it when they trying to get the price down.
See, and you're worried about air conditioning.
Hey,
all right, we got to go, honestly. So, Jeff Sabatini, Car and Driver, thanks a lot for being here. And,
thanks for having me again.
Appreciate your insights and your good humor and demeanor. Dave Sullivan, Auto Pacific. It's good as always. Good seeing you again.
Thank you. Me back.
And for those who remember, Jeff was our fantasy draft Automobile Portlandia. Was that
Automobiles Portlandia?
That's right. So anyway,
I think I lost.
Possibly, I don't remember.
Well, so, I didn't win.
There is that.
He lost.
Right. We just had verification.
Second place is the first loser.
All right. So with that, everyone, thank you for joining us tonight. And we will be here next week. ATS-V, Tony Roma, chief engineer. So come back and honest, we're not going to be off for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or how long we've been gone. So thanks very much.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Henkel, excellence is our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.